The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Friends, welcome once again to my program, Afternoons with Mike, here on The Shepherd. And it's always a joy to be able to talk to attorney David Gibbs from the National Center for Life and Liberty. Welcome once again to my program, sir.
Oh, Mike, it's my honor to be with you.
You know, since we first talked months ago, it is the never-ending saga of life as we now know it post-COVID. And I wondered if you could give us an update on how things are from the legal front, from churches, from some of the restrictions that you're seeing at NCLL?
Well, a lot of folks, and I understand the sentiment because I've had it myself, are wishing things would go back to normal. Like, could we just kind of go back in time to the pre-March time period and the pre-COVID days and not have to be concerned about this virus, or some have labeled a pandemic that swept not just our nation, but the world. And what we've been encouraging churches and ministry leaders and even just citizens and families to realize is that the new normal is going to be the normal for a while, that we are going to be living in a world where public health is going to be a discussion. Our organization does a lot of work, Mike, as you know, with churches and nonprofits and schools and different outreaches, counseling centers and organizations that are trying to make a difference in their communities. And what I've explained to them is, if you go back into the 1980s, a organization being sued for child abuse or mistreatment of a child was basically non-existent. And we've watched where courts and situations over the last 40 years have now created child protection policies. We've watched where shooters, and not just at churches, but houses of worship and other venues, have attacked mass gatherings. And churches and organizations have had to realize safety and security and thinking about how to make sure that the campuses are not attacked by bad actors. And I think that COVID, this virus that has swept our nation, is going to force churches and really all organizations, businesses and others, to think about public health in a different way and to realize that we are going to probably have to evaluate a lot of what we do in light of what can we do to prevent the unnecessary spread of COVID. Now, we all understand if you go live in a bubble and don't do anything that, you know, you've probably minimized your risk of catching any illness. But the bottom line is that balance of maximum ministry, maximum impact, maximum business, and yet to do that with minimal liability. So things like less crowded rooms, social distancing, hand washing, sanitizers, masks, different things that are being encouraged to help mitigate the unnecessary spread of COVID. Those are things that are going to be in the discourse for a while. Now, it is interesting, Mike, you mentioned litigation, and there is a tsunami of COVID litigation that's kind of stacking up in the courts where people are trying to assess what's going to happen. The courts are running behind because of COVID and the liabilities and the things that are going to come forward. What I'm seeing, and by the way, on the good news front, I have not seen any churches or ministries that have been caught in this. And so that's a blessing. But we are watching, for example, where nursing homes, those that are in healthcare for the elderly, are finding themselves sued. We're watching where some funeral homes that maybe didn't protect guests or handle bodies correctly are finding themselves sued. A lot of employers are finding themselves sued. Now, that's a little different element where someone is called into work and then they turn around and say, you did not provide a safe environment. And this is running the gamut across different businesses where people are nervous to go to work and wondering about the precautions. And we're obviously watching many large businesses that are installing different equipment and things. And so the public health world is going to be a discussion for a long time. And so we're encouraging churches and ministries, and not necessarily to fight it, but to embrace it, to realize people are fearful, and we do have the opportunity to minister to them effectively, but to do it in a safe and, to the best of our abilities, a healthy way.
You know, we hear that adage. It's kind of an example, a metaphor about a ship being turned and how long it takes for a large ship to be turned in water. And it does, in the ocean. When we use that metaphor in America, doesn't it seem that this large ship of our country turned abnormally quickly? Is that ever apparent from a legal standpoint, from your standpoint?
Well, I think, yes. I mean, we did really, in my lifetime, so many unprecedented things. I never thought I would live in an America where March Madness would shut down, the professional sports leagues, the NBA and Major League Baseball would shut down, Disney World would close down, churches across the nation were largely closed on Easter Sunday. I mean, we look at what we've lived through, shelter in place and no restaurants being open, and we look at this country of ours, and clearly we did react aggressively. Now, it will be debated historically and politically for generations. Did we overreact? Did we underreact? Mm-hmm. But there's no question that we reacted dramatically. And I think I remind folks that, you know, really in April, which was kind of maybe the height of concern for many, it was Republicans, it was Democrats. It was pretty universal that we had a issue of concern. And whether our reaction helped mitigate the spread or whether it really didn't have impact, experts will be discussing that for a long time, but there's no question it was a radical shift. And there are many pastors and ministry leaders that say, I think we overreacted, or I think this just went too far. And I don't disagree that is certainly a valid point to think about, but it's in the hearts and minds of the people. And so I look at, you know, you have a fearful public, and whether that is genuine fear or misinformation that's being spread through media, you have to think about how do we minister to these folks that are hearing all of these things, and how do we give them confidence that, for example, when they come to church, they're not putting themselves or their families at unnecessary risk.
Yes, indeed, because it is a concern that we are able to do life safely. That is obviously, and I think that from my standpoint, it would appear that part of the reason we were so willing is that, number one, it was so, unprecedented that there could be a disease that would fly into a country the way this one did, and America went from almost having no impact to, as I understand the numbers now that are given to us, we're the world's leader in the amount of cases that is being reported. I think with all of that, many people are still asking the question that you kind of brought up a moment ago. Is this really as bad as it is projecting itself to be? And I'm not sure it is projecting itself. Our media has projected it, the images that we saw. And so I think a lot of people are right now questioning the reality of that, and we are now left with what you said up front, and I agree with you. It would appear that we're in this not for a short haul, not for a couple of week period like it started off being, but we're in this for a long haul. So the question that still people are asking is this necessary?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'm not going to profess to have all of the answers, but I have encouraged churches and citizens to think about it with what I would call a balanced perspective, which, by the way, is what I believe the scripture encourages Christians to do, to let your balance or your moderation be your standard. And I think it is not as bad as it has certainly been hyped up to be. There was a frenzy, a fear of huge numbers, and I'm not mitigating the loss of life. I know some pastors that have died from COVID, and I know some reasonably young people that have had major heart and lung issues due to COVID. So if you do contract it and your body is not inclined to fight it normally, I think a lot of times the autoimmune system actually begins attacking itself. And so it can hit different people differently. Some people show next to no symptoms. They call them asymptomatic, and others it's catastrophic. And so it's a confusing, mutating virus. But I do think you can definitely over concern and worry yourself, and forgetting the fact that ultimately life is a gift from God. God, mm-hmm. and God can give health or take away that blessing. But on the other hand, I think those that say, well, this is a hoax or a hype, I think that's a mistake also. It has hit our elderly, our more vulnerable, our folks that have health issues already. And so it is certainly something to be thoughtful about. And I look at it in terms of, for many people, you say, well, do I have to wear a mask or do I have to do this? Well, you don't have to do anything. But I view it oftentimes as a kindness principle. Paul in the New Testament talked about meat that had been offered to idols, and some of the Christians thought it was wrong to eat that meat. And Paul articulated that, you know, it's really not a problem. But if it's going to cause concern or cause some of the others to question their faith, it's better to just abstain. And the concept was, don't be a stumbling block to your brother. And so I look at this COVID thing as being kind to other people. If people are fearful and they're wearing a mask and they would like me to wear a mask, I will be kind and not put them in fear unnecessarily, because I want to have the opportunity to serve them or bless them or be a ministry to them. And so I think it's important to stay balanced, to stay reasonable. You know, I joke, Mike, you know, it used to be you would sneeze and people would say, God bless you. Now you sneeze and people cross their arms and go, murderer, get away from me. You know, we live in, you know, I grew up being told, you know, you don't call in, you crawl in. Now it's like, if you think you're sick, stay away. And so we have had some cultural shift in all of this. But I've encouraged people to be balanced, to be reasonable. Does it hurt to wash your hands a little more, to periodically put on some hand sanitizer? Probably not. That was probably not a half bad idea ahead of COVID. We just, as a culture, weren't that careful about it. Now we're being a little more careful. Is social distancing in churches, you know, going to totally ruin the fact that we are holding services? No, I think you, if you have the facilities, can think about things that you can do to still have what I call maximum ministry, but do it with minimal liability. And the goal here is to avoid the unnecessary spread of this virus. Mm-hmm. And so as we think about that, I just encourage folks to, you know, we're in a society right now where, I mean, people are driving with more angst. People are fearful about their futures, decision fatigue. You know, a lot of folks had their kids thrust into their home. Every American became a homeschooler, and a lot of parents decided they didn't like their kids that much. And so there's been a lot of stress in our culture. And so I've encouraged people to, you know, not fight right into the stress and add to it for the society. But if churches and ministry leaders would say, look, we understand you're going through a lot, but let me come alongside you with encouragement, with love, with the salvation of Jesus Christ, that there are things you can do to be effective in your ministering. And I've encouraged churches, you know, long after COVID is in the rearview mirror of history, there are going to be other viruses, other issues, but you will live with your testimony and your spirit and how you behaved yourself during this time. And I've encouraged people to think over the long haul, not just in the imminent frustration of, wow, I just heard about this mandate, or this just came up, or this is being asked of us. And don't let those temporary frustrations hurt your long-term reputation.
That's great advice. And one thing that I think that we have to temper that kind of reaction to is the fact that so many what would appear to be municipalities' directives, some giving lockdowns, some strong restrictions are being kind of passed along, not legally speaking, but also, but just basically through declarations that are being made, executive decisions by governors, by mayors. When you look at that kind of a scenario where these restrictions are being given, but not from a legal, not from a law standpoint being voted on, what concerns you the most about the atmosphere right now?
Well, I think there's a few things to be concerned about, but let me begin that most of these ordinance mandates, declarations, you know, from the White House down to the lowest levels of government are authorized under emergency power provisions. Okay. And I'll use an example, you know, an act of war. 9/11 occurred and there were orders to stay out of New York. And somebody goes, wait a minute, I flew to New York. I want to tour the city. And their constitutional rights were violated under emergency orders because we're under attack. People are dying. We got to turn all the roads for people to get out. And that's an act of war. President at the time, we remember President Bush grounding all the planes. Well, imagine your aggravation if you're flying from, you know, let's say Philadelphia to Orlando, and now all of a sudden you're landed in South Carolina. I mean, people were very intruded upon by their government, but everybody understood we're at war, our country's under attack, this is for the safety of everyone. And these emergency powers kind of had that component to them, that in a true emergency, we want our government to be able to have the authority to act in the best interest of the people. The problem we have is they were never really designed for long-lasting emergencies or pandemics or health issues. They were designed more for temporary acts of war, violence, protests, things where the government needs to step in quickly and protect people. And I think what we've watched is a little bit of this, you know, the government acting more like a nanny state, like we're going to make you do what's good for you, as opposed to a protector, like where we're going to step in and make sure that you're not under attack. And so I think these laws, ordinances, authorities have been distorted beyond what they were ever intended. And we've been contacted by a number of legislators across the nation that are saying, you know what, we want to kind of look at our emergency authority for whether it's our governor or our leaders to make sure that it's appropriate, that it's being applied appropriately. And I would remind folks that, you know, we're really dealing with the whole purpose of government. I mean, is the purpose of government to protect your rights and to punish evildoers? And I call that more of the limited government philosophy, which, by the way, is what our founding fathers intended.
Yes.
Or is the government the one that's to come in and make us do things that are good for us? And I remind folks that the case on Obamacare, and I'm not wading into the politics of healthcare or not, but it was an interesting decision. And many folks remember that Justice Roberts kind of flipped with the more liberal wing of the court and said that it is okay, basically, for the government to make you do things that are good for you. So purchasing health care, I think everybody'd say, well, it's probably good for you, but don't I have the right not to? I mean, what if I don't have the money or don't want to? And the court pretty much said that, you know, the government can sort of force people to do healthy things. And it was kind of an interesting constitutional issue, because as a general rule, the role of government to force people to behave in a way that the government deems is good for them was really never the American way. It was never the constitutional way. And we've watched that kind of continue to grow, whether it's forcing you to purchase health care or dealing with those issues, to now, you know, we are going to force you as citizens to take actions that we believe are good for your health and the health of others. And I think that's where people are feeling the tension. You know, has our government gotten out of bounds? Have they gone too far? Mm-hmm. Are they dictating, you know, what in their opinion is good? But what if I disagree? And I think we're going to see this issue continue to be wrestled out. I realize there's a lot of discussion about, you know, immunizations and can a vaccine be provided for COVID, or will it, you know, work effectively? Has it been tested effectively? And I think we're going to watch where when things are started to be released into the culture, that there's again going to be government push. You know, your children have to receive this or they can't go back to public school, or you have to receive this or you can't come back to work. And we're going to see more and more pressure where the government is saying, we know what's best for the people. And that is a little bit disconcerting, because that has historically not been the American way. It's been understood that in America, at least as our founders interpreted it, that your rights come to you from God. You live because God gives you life. You speak because God gives you that ability. You worship because that's within your spirit. You defend yourself or your family because that's within you. And that the government doesn't give you those rights, all a government can do is potentially infringe or take away those rights. And so the founders were always looking to make sure that the government, whether the federal government or the state government, that they did not intrude upon the God-given rights of the people.
You know, when I think back to that time where the Supreme Court did back the Obamacare, it in doing so, it more or less, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it redefined that from being more a healthcare issue to becoming a tax. And it was more or less called just that, a tax that the government could do. And while the government may not have historically been given the freedom to wade into things like private health insurance in the name of a tax, it could do that. And so doing, those that were proponents for Obamacare accepted that kind of evolution, if you will, of the term, and it passed in that way. And some would feel that it was almost a backdoor way for it to come in and become effective. And I'm wondering if the care that the government is giving right now over this issue, could it evolve in some way, in some backdoor method as well, with regards to these limitations, especially limitations on churches, which is really a concern I think that many pastors have, is that could it be evolving in terms of how it's being approached by the government?
Yes. I mean, Mike, you've got your thumb on the issue. And, you know, philosophically, and I'm a constitutional attorney, and there's some very intelligent listeners that could go into the nuanced constitutional arguments. And you're absolutely right. Justice Roberts found a way to support Obamacare and relabeling it, you know, instead of a mandate as a tax. And they found legal justification for the end result. But the end result was the government deciding what's best for you, and it being forced on the people, mm-hmm. and those that did not comply would be punished. And I do think we are going to see additional infringements. Now, are some of them going to be, you know, atrocious, or some of them going to be fairly minor? We don't know. It's going to depend on who you elect, who your government officials are, where you live. We are blessed that Florida has been a state that has prioritized more so than some other jurisdictions where I'm litigating and working on cases, the freedom of the people. But I do think from a ministry perspective, you can expect crowd limitations. I mean, I would definitely not be encouraging churches to be building mammoth auditoriums. Now is not the moment for the 1,000 to 5,000 seat auditorium, because that may end up sitting empty or greatly reduced in size. And so I think church leaders need to think proactively, probably more frequent services, probably smaller gatherings, larger churches meeting more often. A food service is going to be an issue that, you know, what type of regulation, the old homecoming, just, you know, everybody brings a dish, throws it out back. Those type of events are probably going to be more discouraged as potential health risks. Extra cleaning, you know, the sanitation levels. And please understand, I think most churches stayed reasonably clean. But, you know, if the trash cans were empty and we vacuumed stuff up, it wasn't a thought that we had to go through and wipe pews and sanitize fabric and be thinking at another level. And so I do think churches are going to have to keep their budgets up on the cleaning and the moving between services and limiting unnecessary clustering, you know, the old, you know, let's put 20 people quickly in a small bathroom in and out in between a service. I think we're going to see more building structures and more ministry plans that have things more on a one-on-one basis or in a smaller group, with the idea that we want to try to protect public health. And it's not just COVID. Obviously, that's what has forced a lot of this discussion. But we are going to be seeing other viruses, other flus, other mutations. And so as our society wrestles with protecting people's health, I think there's going to be some expectation that churches, businesses, and others that gather people together are going to have to think about standards that better protect public health. Do I see restaurants just packing again and putting people everywhere? That may be a long time in coming.
Mm. There's a prominent church in California that has been in the news, and I've heard it's not a secret thing. They're actually on the air talking in interviews about the feeling that they ended up coming to, that with regards to California's stringent lockdown laws on churches especially, that it came to them to become a matter of, do I obey man or do I obey God? Do you see that sentiment happening with churches in Florida?
I see it less in Florida because Florida was more freedom-oriented, okay? I mean, I'm not going to obviously publicly disclose any, but there were some churches in Florida that never closed. They just said, you know what, we're going to be careful. We've got a big building. We're and I mean, and they literally never shut their doors. And they just made that decision for themselves. And then others obviously went to online, different hybrid models. With regard to the one in California, and again, it's a very public case, and he is a good man, Dr. Mm-hmm. John MacArthur, and I know Dr. MacArthur and hold him in esteem. But he made a decision that I probably would have maybe cautioned gently against, and he just said enough is enough, and he kind of positioned that we're not going to socially distance, we're not going to abstain from shaking hands or hugging, we're not going to wear masks, we're going to jam into our building, and I'm going to have 10 to 12,000 people, and we're just kind of tired of all this. And he kind of made a point that he is going to have church, and then he sued and initiated litigation. And I've encouraged churches to realize that when you initiate litigation, you're positioned differently. You're going before a judge, which is a government employee, and asking them to criticize and attack other government employees. And you better have a pretty strong case, because there's always a general sentiment to defer to the decisions of other branches of government. And I've worked with hundreds of churches across California, all of which are open and meeting and able to function. But I have encouraged, you know, doing everything you can to comply, you know, the cleaning, the sanitation, the separation, and don't take on your government. And if you are approached by your law enforcement or public health or others, to explain to them what you're doing, why you're doing it, and to ask them to respectfully honor your decisions as a church. And we have not had one church in California challenged or closed that have taken what I would call the more reasonable approach. Now, Dr. MacArthur is a very smart man, and he made a decision, and he has decided to challenge it. And right now, he has lost in court. There's still pending appeals. He's facing significant fines. And I certainly wish him well in that litigation. But I have found in this pandemic, with the current Supreme Court indicating in cases that they are not going to rule in favor of churches over these government officials, that you are wiser to be smart about it and diplomatic about it than you are to be dogmatic about it.
Hmm. That is some good advice, and a real, I believe, sober assessment about the scenario. And I think that it does weigh in on every believer, because we want to do what's right before the Lord. We want to do what's right in eyes of the civil sphere. I think Romans 13 is enough of a scriptural basis for us to realize that authority is given by God, and we don't want to just in a cavalier way. And I think that's the real key, isn't it? That we just don't want to become reckless in how we approach things, how we answer things. But at the same time, there comes that point, and I don't know that I've ever seen a scenario that's more prominent than this one, where that line becomes a little grayed out, a little hard to see, less focused, where on one hand, we want to obey God and we want to do what's right as well.
Well, Mike, you're spot on, and it's a very tough balance. You know, I often tell people you got to do the right stand the right way with a right spirit. And I do agree that the spirit is very important. You know, I'll use a personal example. I don't particularly enjoy a mask. It pulls my ears forward. It makes my face hot. I feel like I'm breathing my own, you know, carbon dioxide. Yeah. It's not something that I personally would enjoy, but I don't have a faith-based objection to it. I mean, I can't point to a Bible verse that says, do not wear masks, you know, and so I have to take my own personal aggravation. I don't enjoy it, but if I'm going to get on an airplane, walk into a restaurant, or go into a facility that requires it or requests it, I'm going to be a Christian gentleman, and I'm going to comply, and I'm going to not let it ruin my day. And I think there's a lot of folks that are letting the aggravations of dealing with COVID disrupt their spirits. And I would just encourage folks not to let it become an unnecessary stressor. You know, there's a lot of things worse than having some minor inconveniences. And so looking at it with a little more of a relaxed approach. Mm. And if somebody says, I'm not going to put a mask on and sit on an airplane, all right, then hop in your car and go where you need to go. I mean, you have options. And I just encourage folks. They say, I'm not wearing a mask into a restaurant. Well, then, you know, don't go. You know, don't, you know, they'll let you take it off when you sit down. It's sort of silly. But, you know, at the end of the day, I encourage folks to, you know, when you can reasonably comply and realize that a lot of times your testimony of who and what you are, that your children sees, that your family sees, and certainly that a watching world sees, is your reaction to circumstances you don't like. Mm-hmm. And I just encourage folks to, you know, if they come out and say, you cannot preach Jesus, okay, we all need to rally and fight. That is a affront on speech, religion, and certainly the gospel and what Christians believe is their mandate and purpose on earth. But if they say you need to do a few things to help mitigate this public health risk, there's other situations we comply with that we, you know, may or may not like, but it's what we now do. So if it's talking on a cell phone, you know, and holding it up to your ear or putting on a seatbelt, or if you drive a motorcycle, wearing a helmet or not, we certainly as Americans have cherished our freedom, but we've always had some balance of certain aggravations we all put up with because we deem it as a protector. When you go to the airport, very innocent, very nice people are put through metal detectors and have their luggage scanned. It's not that we're assuming everyone is a criminal, but we want to make sure that our public transportation remains as safe as we can. And mm-hmm. So you're always balancing these things, you know, aggravations on civil liberties with public safety. And I just encourage Christians, when we deal with these issues, let's not lose our credibility on things that are not biblical. When we're going to take that stand, let's make sure that we're really fighting for something that is truly scriptural.
There's an old saying that says we need to be careful to choose our battles well. And I think that really does apply in this one. Attorney David Gibbs from NCLL, the National Center for Life and Liberty, thank you so much for being with me today. It's always a joy to have you here.
My honor, and I appreciate your voice and leadership, and thank you for the privilege of being on your program.
Well, God bless you, and you have a good day. We'll be back in a moment here on Afternoons with Mike. We're back again here on Afternoons with Mike, and it is my joy to introduce for the first time to my program a friend who is an editor-in-chief of a digital newspaper in Gainesville. It's a relatively new one, and it is a great one. It's called the Main Street Daily News, and the editor-in-chief is none other than Reggie Connell. Reggie, welcome to my program.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's great to be on.
Well, I can't tell you how much I've looked forward to this. It's kind of like a really natural hand-in-glove kind of thing, because while we are owned by the same company, the Shepherd and Main Street Daily News, we are not strangers either in the sense of relationally. And I met you last year. You moved up to Gainesville from Apopka, and you and your wife still maintain the Apopka Voice, and it is a great digital newspaper in the Orlando area as well. So give us a little bit about your background. First of all, tell us about your relationship with the Lord. How did that happen?
Well, I was from North Carolina, Mike, so of course I was a Baptist from birth. I kind of, somewhere in my teenage years, I kind of fell away a little bit. Then with the birth of my daughter, I think that's kind of a common story, and that was when I got back in to a Methodist church. I stayed with them for quite a while and then ended up at a non-denominational church called Sabbath Grace Fellowship in the Orlando. It was actually in Apopka, and I was just very inspired by the pastors there. Ultimately, I ended up as board chair at that church and taught the Bible study class and just really was inspired by it all. And I think that's pretty much my story on that.
When you look back, Reggie, over your lifetime now and those values that your family held in North Carolina and the upbringing that would have been in a predominantly Christian society, at least that's the way I think a lot of people would have felt. We're living today in what is a drifting culture. Many people say the secular mindset is stronger today than ever. How do you look back on the values that you were raised with there in North Carolina? What do you think of now when you look at today?
Actually, I might push back a bit on that assessment. There's been studies done by Barna and others that while, yes, Christianity isn't quite as popular in America as it was, it's still at 70%. And then there's another category of people who consider themselves spiritual, yet not of any particular denomination. And I just feel like as Christians, we should be out there, not necessarily evangelizing, but definitely out in the public, being sort of a symbol of what Christianity is and can be. So that's what I try to do. I don't do a lot of evangelizing in public, but I will, if the subject comes up, I'm more than happy to talk about Jesus as long as you want.
How
I think for me, it's more in a journalistic world that I'm in, I think that's a better example.
That is a great answer, and I love to hear that thought about pushing back, because being a journalist as you are, and a good one as you are, it does seem to me that you would be standing often alone among journalists in the media and the culture. Your voice, your thoughts would not be held by many of your peers. At least that would be what I would think would be a reasonable statement. Would you agree with that?
I think you'd be surprised. It's not that I've been in a million newsrooms and can give you a poll, but I can guarantee you I've never been in a newsroom where I was the only Christian.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that comes up as much as it would in other businesses, I would suppose. But I can list a lot of Christians that are still, you know, a part of journalism, and you know, they walk that life. It's just not something that's known or that's talked about a great deal in journalism and newspapers and things like that.
Well, I appreciate the stand that you're taking, and it, to me, is very encouraging even to hear you say that, and I'm grateful, because I spent a lot of time back in, not so much in written news, but in broadcast news back in the 70s and 80s, and I'm really glad to hear you say that. My experience would not have been the same, sadly, in that area. There were a few, but I felt often alone back up in those days. So it is good to know that your experience was a little bit different. You're a writer. When did you first find out that you had a knack for writing?
Probably in high school. I was in a journalism class, not the newspaper itself, and I wrote some stories, and the teacher thought I had stolen from the St. Pete Times. So she actually called them, and they're like, no, that's not any of our stuff.
Accused of plagiarism right then.
First, right off the bat, accused of plagiarism. But I just enjoyed it a lot. I like the idea of reporting as well as writing. I am more probably a writer than journalist, but I'd say it's like 51 to 49%. I enjoy both sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up writing a book before I got back into journalism in Apopka in 2015. I started with the Apopka Voice then,
mm-hmm.
and then I worked with them right up until I started with Main Street. And then, right, my wife Denise is continuing to do the Apopka Voice right now.
Now, when you look back and you're a writer, like you said, what goes into... I think a lot of people, they love books, they read books, or they wish they read books, but few people ever write a book, actually author a book. What does it take for a person to actually complete a written book? What does it take?
I think in my case is probably unique. I wrote in probably 2002, I read a book about medieval kings, and one, Frederick, really stood out to me. And over the next 8 years, I think I wrote 10,000 words, just more of an outline kind of idea. Then a little after 2010, I had a amount of time where I had the discipline to sit down at night and write like for 2 or 3 hours. And I wrote probably 100,000 words in those 2 years.
Mm.
And among those, you know, it edited down to about 80,000, and it ended up being a book.
Wow.
So most people, I think, probably take a couple years and, you know, diligently write 1,000 words a day or something, like some kind of a goal like that.
Uh-huh.
In my case, it was kind of a marathon and then a sprint at the end to do most all the rest of the work. I wouldn't recommend doing it like that, but that's how it worked for me. To me, a book just has to be in you as a writer, and then you must get it on the pages. That's why I think it survived as long as it did.
Mm-hmm.
And my head was, it was in there, and I just wanted to tell the story of that king. So
now daily,
that's how it worked for me.
Daily writing, then, is an exercise that is not only a discipline, but it is something that could be determined to be practice. Would that be fair to say that it is a good, it's good for practice to write daily?
Oh, I would, if you're a writer, I would say the best thing you can do is to get up in the morning and write like 1,000 words. And in general, don't even let the pen like leave the paper. Don't go back and edit. Don't think about what you're writing. Just write. Obviously, you're going to have to refine what you write at some point, but I think that's, you know, that's almost like morning exercises for an athlete or something.
What are your thoughts about journaling?
I think it's great. I don't personally do that any longer, but I did it for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way for a would-be writer to get started.
And it's valuable, too, for that person's family to look back on what you would have written. And I guess they get a picture into their loved one's life that they would not have had otherwise. But that is something. I've got some friends who are just avid journalists. They are a journalist in the right sense of the word.
Right.
They write, they journal every day and fill book after book, and they've got their books, their journals all organized. And
wow.
I look at that and I go, well, my family's not going to have that experience when I pass.
Like I said, I haven't done it in years, but I do think it would be very helpful to the individual as well to be able to say, you know, I was thinking of something a couple of years ago, and to be able to go back into that journal and say, oh, yeah, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
The thought that I had that I couldn't remember. So, I mean, there's practical reasons for that as well. But I would definitely recommend anyone journal that has that notion.
Well, you are now part of this big, exciting adventure called the Main Street Daily News, and it's based in Gainesville. Tell us about it. What has the journey been like for you?
It was quite a journey, actually. We launched on March the 2nd. I had about 10 categories that I wanted to cover. We labeled it as a hyper-local online news site, basically telling the story of Gainesville, everything to do with Gainesville. And then 2 weeks later, on March the 16th, obviously COVID happened, or that was when it started to get almost all encompassing. And we transitioned into a hyper COVID news site, still local to Gainesville and the region. But we went from 10 different categories that we were covering basically to one. And it was anything to do with COVID, where you could go to get tested, any kind of medical information, everything you can imagine. We were averaging, for those 2 weeks before, about 40 stories a week. We went from that to about 100 each week, and 99% of them had something to do with the coronavirus. So it was tough to make that transition, but that's what we had to do as a, you know, as a news site. Even though we were brand new, we still felt the obligation to our community to switch to the topic that was most prominent and most important in pretty much everybody's lives at that time.
How were people finding you in that time frame?
I'm generally proactive when it comes to people finding us. So rather than, you know, starting a site and just hoping they find us, I would take stories to popular Facebook pages throughout the area, in Gainesville, in Alachua County, and slowly we started to build an audience through that. Then Suzette Cook, who is one of our staff writers, wrote a story about a Gainesville doctor who invented sort of a surgical mask that could be cleaned and reused. And that story just went wild. I think we ended up with 700,000 unique visits or clicks onto that story.
Wow.
Which I've been in online journalism for 6 years, I've never had a story go beyond 100,000, I don't think, just to put that in perspective, let alone the fact that it was a brand new site. For that to happen was just astounding.
Mm.
So that helped a lot as far as new visitors to the site.
And then people, once they find the site, obviously they can favor it and visit it on a daily basis then.
In those first couple months, we had hundreds of thousands of visits, and a lot of them were from out of state to do with Suzette's story. She also did a series on Gainesville nurses that went up to New York to help out during the COVID crisis that was up there so prominently in March and April. So we kept those audiences, but also another thing that we did was occasionally we'd run a story about one of the counties that intersects or that is attached to Alachua County, Columbia County, Dixie County, Levy County. And those stories would just blow up, like stories that weren't, I wouldn't call them major or breaking, just a story about something that's happening in Levy County. And we determined that these, while there are publications there, they're not really online. So they're almost like what we call news deserts. Almost the fact that there were stories about Levy County or Columbia being published, just they took to it. So we kind of, our third stage was we're now focused a little bit more on these smaller counties and smaller towns in Alachua. Mm-hmm. And it's really, we've boomed as far as readership goes since we've done that. So we expanded kind of to Northeast or North Central Florida, that region, and it's really helped our readership quite a bit. Mm. And I think we've provided a service to those counties that aren't used to seeing a lot of news about themselves on, you know, on social media or on an online news site that's more daily. So if something happens in a small county, I can report on it and publish it within minutes of the occurrence.
Now, you mentioned hyperlocal, so that's what you mean by that, is that you're intensely focused on the happenings of that community. What would be some of the other, let's say, distinguishing features of Main Street Daily News?
Well, I think hyperlocal it's almost hyperlocal to a kind of a broad region. We're also faster than any print newspaper can be. We can put a story up almost immediately. We know who's reading and how many readers that type of story gets. We know, you know, it's online, so we've got statistics and analytics to show what stories are resonating. I think at this point we're probably as diverse a news site as there is in the Gainesville and greater Gainesville area. So I would say that would be the other aspect, is mm-hmm. There's a diversity of different stories that are coming out. We're covering not only politics and government, but we have a pretty strong, I'd say, inspiration and religion section that you're a big part of, and thank you for that.
Mm, it's my privilege to write a weekly column for that, and I'm grateful to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's doing great. I appreciate it as well. But we're covering probably a dozen different types of subjects, and we've expanded it into these smaller counties. So I feel like we're almost doing a public service for these areas that just aren't used to that. They're not used to seeing breaking news about themselves.
Wow. And, you know, like you said, it is a digital newspaper. It's as fast as getting something up on the internet. And everyone can understand how fast that is in this day. So it's
right.
As fast as anyone can write a post on Facebook, the Main Street Daily News can get a breaking story that is of great interest. So when you have something in Alachua County that is a big story, like an automobile accident, sad as it is to think about that, if somebody's wanting to find out news about it, you guys are a great first stop to get to that, because you're Johnny on the gun and getting those stories up and on the internet.
Right. We're almost always first on, you know, like you said, it's unfortunate there's a crash or what might happen during the day, but we're almost always going to be first with any sort of breaking news that happens, simply because, you know, I type it in and publish it and it's on our site. Mm. There is to it for us.
A lot of people wondered if there were going to be any high school sports at all this year because of COVID. But thankfully, and I'm excited to realize that there are schools that are doing the football programs, and Main Street is right there, a part of that as well.
Right. That's we just started that about, well, this is week three that we're doing right now. And yes, it's been, again, the smaller counties, their football is king pretty much in Columbia and Levy County and Suwannee mm-hmm. County, all of these. So we're able to cover each game. Basically, we're breaking the news of the final score. I think we did 12 high school football games last week. We did 10 the week before. We did two last night, and I think there's 15 games on the schedule for tonight.
It's going to be a busy weekend.
It definitely is. We hopefully we'll have them all up before midnight, though, tonight. Mm. So we try to break them. As soon as there's a final score, we write a quick story and get it up there and onto the social media for that particular area. And it's definitely gone well, but yes, I think we're all thankful in the sports world. Well, we're playing high school football.
For a brand new publication, a digital publication, you guys are just doing it. I mean, your graphics, the overall look of the Main Street Daily News, it's just absolutely beautiful. And congratulations on being nominated for the Lion Award. Why don't you explain that to our listeners, what that means?
Well, yeah, thank you for that. And Lion is an acronym for Local Independent Online News Site. I think the organization's probably about 5 years old. For the last 2 years, they've held awards for different things to do with journalism and publishing a news site. And one of the what we're up for in the award is emerging publisher, which means you've launched within the last year. You can't mm-hmm. be older than 1 year. We're in the final four.
Wow.
We submitted our application about a month ago and just found out yesterday that we're up against three other news sites, all of which are in much bigger cities. So the fact that we launched in March, which wasn't that long ago, and we're, I would call Gainesville kind of a mid-sized town, but we're going up against much bigger cities mm-hmm. that applied. So it's an honor. I've been a member of Lion since, I think, the beginning. When I was with the Apopka Voice, and it's an organization that I believe in quite a bit and very proud to be in the final four with those other three.
Well, your website is mainstreetdailynews.com, and all people need to do is type that into their browser, and boom, the news is right there. Reggie Connell, thank you for being with me today on the program.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks again.
It's exciting, and I can't wait to see how this digital newspaper is going to grow in the weeks and months ahead. And friends, thank you for being with me today on Afternoons with Mike. We'll catch you next time right here on The Shepherd.